Good evening, my friends and neighbors here in Ketchikan, Alaska, and the surrounding area. My name is Jack Finnegan. I am delighted to have made it to the radio station on time. It has been a very Arts Council-heavy evening for me and will continue to be tomorrow as I have the great fortune of being the MC for this year's Wearable Arts Show, which concluded only minutes ago at the Sunny Point Conference Room down by the landing. A magnificent show with some stunning pieces. And if you're not one of those lucky few who gets to be on the St. John, operated by Alan Marine, for tomorrow's afternoon performance of the Wearable Art Show, I dearly hope that the Arts Council puts these pieces on display, as they typically do in the art gallery at some point in the near future, because there were some really, really stunning works. I know we're a little bit off schedule. We were originally broadcasting these shows on the first Saturday of each month, but it turned out to be a bit of a bear for the Arts Council staff. They usually have an opening on Fridays, and so we've shifted the radio edition of the Stories at Latitude 56 to the third Saturday of each month for the foreseeable future, and we do want to continue this program. And I'm delighted to announce, if you didn't see it in the paper already, that beginning next month and carrying on for the second Tuesday of every month into perpetuity, we will be resuming our in-person Stories at Latitude 56 Story Slam on the second Tuesday of each month at the Creek Street Cabaret. We have a number of themes for those for the Summer Slam, which will begin in May and go through September, and then we'll get back into our regular season starting in the autumn of this year. And just being at the Sunny Point Conference Room this evening, everyone was very mindful of the mitigation plan that was in place. The performers wore masks. I wore a mask. The audience wore masks, except for when they were eating their dinner or sipping at their drinks. But it is so nice to see us getting to a point where we can begin to gather and enjoy and appreciate each other's creativity, dedication, imagination. I said to the crowd this evening as I was ready to run out the door, I'm just so proud to be a part of this town where so many people give so much of themselves so much of the time. And it is really, truly a blessing for me to have any relationship to all of these artists, even as a consumer of their work. But being able to stand in front of that room and introduce each of those pieces was really a pleasure for me. And now I get to be in this studio in a suit, which I never expected. 9 p.m. on Saturdays, I thought I'd be in sweatpants. But tonight I'm in a suit, and I'm delighted to share a few stories with you. And, you know, we decided to try for a theme for the radio edition because we thought that might generate a few more inquiries about prospective storytellers. And I thought work would be an interesting theme because we've all had either bad jobs or great jobs or learned lessons on jobs or seen incredible things on jobs. And it was mostly crickets. So I had to reach into my bag of tricks, I suppose you'd say, and call on a couple of people who are pretty dependable storytellers. And I've got three great stories for you tonight. One of them has to do with that theme of work, and the other are about more personal experiences in lands far from here. And part of that is one thing that's really interesting to me about tonight's storytellers is two of them are a mother-son pairing. And just a few months ago, I had that same privilege. I had Grant Echohawk tell a story, and his mother, Hilaire Echohawk, also shared a story in the same broadcast. And so it's really interesting tonight to hear these two storytellers, one of whom lives here in town. The other is his mother lives in Michigan. She's a pretty experienced storyteller herself. Her name is Beverly Black. And in fact, to the best of my knowledge, she is the president of the Storytelling Association, or Guild, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which I believe is where she makes her home. And many of you may know her son, Keith Smith, who is a friend and colleague of mine, former boss. And we're going to hear a story from him as well. But we're going to start things off with a story from Beverly Black. And I'm going to turn the microphone over to her now.
When I reached 60... I was planning to work until I was 65 or even 70, but it didn't happen that way. 2 years later, I had such a demanding job that I was working long hours. I hadn't had a vacation day in over a year, and when the Human Resources Department at the U of M called me and told me that I either had to take some vacation days or I would lose them. And my son at the same time was encouraging me to come and visit them in Tarija, Bolivia, over the month of Christmas. I decided to go. Now, my plane out of Miami was delayed, and I was exhausted. I had worked 70 hours the week before, and my eyes were so tired that I couldn't even focus to read. Finally, my plane took off at 3 a.m. in the morning. We were about a half hour out, and I was just starting to nod off when, "Fasten your seatbelts." My eyes popped open, and there was a dim, eerie light in the cabin, and I looked out the window. The engine was on fire. Fire was spitting out of it. So I managed to get it out by turning off all of the engines. And we could tell that the pilot got the plane turned around, and we assumed that it was headed back to Miami. But we didn't know. All we knew was we were out over the ocean. We had no motors, no engine power, and we were losing altitude. That was the longest half hour I have spent in my life. And I decided during that time, if I got down safe, I, first of all, would change my life. No more working more than 40 hours a week. More fun, more creative pursuits, more time with family and friends. So when we did get to the airport, coming in very low, the runway was lined with fire engines and ambulances. When we came to a very slow rolling stop, safely, we all stood up and clapped. We found out that if we had been out 10 minutes further, we would have had to make an ocean landing. Well, when I got off the plane, I went and called my daughter, Cindy. And when I heard her voice, I just burst out crying. And it took a long time before I could tell her what had happened. Now, they housed all of us in one hotel for 24 hours, and we ate all our food together, and we talked, and many stories came out about reactions to the danger. One man and woman were on their way for him to meet her parents, and he pulled out a ring that he had been saving for a romantic moment and said, "If we get down safe, will you marry me?" Another man and woman were strangers when they got on, and they were a couple when they got off. And they were married a year later. When we finally got on our plane to continue our journey, we had become a very tight-knit group. 36 hours late, I got to Torija. And once in the arms of my son, the tears flowed again. Now, Torija is an idyllic place to be. Mediterranean climate, a relaxed lifestyle, vineyards, and the flowers blooming all over town made even the most run-down building seem exotic. The colorful attire of the natives and the open-air market created an atmosphere of beauty and abundance. Our first outing was to hike up into the nearby mountain and to cut a Christmas tree. Oh, it felt so good to be out in nature and hiking and fresh air. And it really made me renew my determination when I got back to Ann Arbor to spend more time doing such things. We cut a 4-foot-tall spike of yellow flowers from the yucca plant. And once it was in its stand with lights around the bottom, it was stunning, and there was no need for other ornaments. Towards the end of my stay there, we went on a camping trip up into the mountains and highlands. And to get there, we had to go up a steep mountain on a one-way road that had many switchbacks and very few places where you could pass an oncoming car or pull off and let them go by. Now, this road was not for the faint of heart, because many of the cars coming the other way, all old beat-up things, cars and trucks, were usually driven by a native person who had a nerves of steel and a penchant for going fast. And there was evidence of drivers who had not gotten out of their way, or could not, by looking over the steep mountain, and there was a graveyard of old, battered cars and trucks way down at the bottom. The Highlands were beautiful. We had a good time, and one day we came over the hill, and there in the distance was a beautiful, picturesque steeple, which led us to a village square where all of the villagers, dressed in their best finery, were gathered in celebration. And the older men were playing tap your toe, lovely music on ancient instruments, and children of various ages were singing and dancing what we call the maypole, and adults standing around clapping and swaying to the music or in small groups talking. When they saw us, they welcomed us. They came and they wanted us to join them. We were there for about an hour enjoying the festivities when some of the women brought out refreshments. A really delicious, tangy drink and a tasty pastry. And me being their oldest guest, they served me first. And it's their custom to serve the honored one first. And then everybody stands around and watches them eat. And then they get served. Well, there's the only thing I could do was accept their offering and eat it with great relish and compliments. And then they got served. And soon we excused ourselves, thanked them for their hospitality, and went on our way. And it was only then that Keith told me that I had just had a native drink called chicha. Now, chicha is made by women in the villages sitting around chewing corn until it goes to mush, and then spitting it out in a common bowl. And this is left to ferment, and it's the basis of this drink. Yeah. I wondered if I would be sorry later. When it came time to go home to Ann Arbor, it took a lot of courage to get onto that plane. And once home, my work had piled up, and I started immediately working long hours. And as I thought about my promise to myself, all I could say is, have to wait for that until I catch up. 2 weeks later, I was flat on my back in the hospital with a very bad case of hepatitis. I wondered if, as I lay there, if I could have brought myself to turn down those refreshments. But also in my delirium, I thought of this terribly offensive joke. There was a beautiful wedding, and the man and woman, the bride and groom, after the wedding, took off in a buggy pulled by a mule. After a while, the mule stopped, and the man said, "That's one," and he whipped the mule and got it to start again. When the mule stopped again later, he said, "That's two." And he whipped it again and it started. The third time, he said, "That's three." And he pulled out a gun and shot it in the head. And his new wife started yelling at him and saying, "What on earth did you do that for? That was such an imbecile thing." He said, "That's one." Well, in my delirium, I started wondering if my plane ride had been one and my hepatitis two. When I finally went back to work and found it was almost impossible to keep my hours to 40, and then I was diagnosed with high blood pressure and diabetes, to avoid that three, I retired.
Now that is a sound I miss, the sound of laughter and applause. And who wouldn't clap at the end of a story like that? What an astonishing set of images, and what an adventure with its twists and turns, and I mean flames from the engine of the plane that you're flying on. I've had some turbulent flights and some near misses in automobiles, but I've never experienced anything quite like that. And yes, I do believe it took a great deal of courage to get on that return flight. And just the chicha. When Keith floated to me the idea, was it chicha? Was that the name of the beverage? When he floated to me the notion, as I was inviting him to contribute a story to this program, He mentioned the possibility of perhaps his mother telling a story as well. And he made a passing reference to a beverage and a hospital visit, but I had no idea what kind of story I was in store for. And I'm so grateful to Beverly for sharing that recording of a story that she obviously shared in front of a live audience. And that's something that I look forward to doing with all of you again in the not-too-distant future. And now to go on to the very son that she mentioned in that tale, who I do wonder when Keith saw her drinking that beverage if he knew, certainly not that she was going to come down with hepatitis, but definitely how that drink was made. I wonder how tickled he was by the fact that she didn't know what she was getting herself into. But Keith's got a story for us next.
Ended up in Brazil on an adventure looking for something exquisite back in the, not exquisite, exotic, as if anything exotic really ever exists. Where we ended up with this, one of the oldest parts of European civilization in the Americas, in the Northeast, where inland in the kind of aggressive drought riddled rocky agricultural land inland from Recife and Olinda, which are two of the oldest cities in the Americas. Recife has canals, old 16th century architecture built by the Dutch. The Portuguese drove them out, giving you a sense of how old it is. Mm-hmm. They got in their ships and they went and founded New York. So instead of finding anything exotic, what I found there was like the carcass of Western civilization and something, a people alive and gentle, but abraded by ruthless poverty there. So one of the things of being in such a poor area was it was one of my only experiences in my life of being rich. And so, you know, I mean, everything, you know, you go, everything's so cheap. And that was a trip for a while. Like, just a ripe 10-cent amazing pineapple. So you buy a lot of pineapples, right? Mm-hmm. You couldn't believe how cheap and wonderful the pineapples were. Well, the other thing that was cheap was helping people. So in a way, we started out there for a year and ended up living there directly 3 years. And in a way, we were traveling on I don't even know whether it's good or bad, on the trip of generosity. Helping people was utterly changing people's life was so cheap. And it was sort of fascinating, interesting, but it took us this road deep into the lives of a family. You know, just buying the town a soccer ball. You could completely change the town by buying them a soccer ball because the old soccer ball was broke and no one had enough money to buy a new one. Or helping someone get started in a jewelry business, or buying vaccines for kids, or getting them dewormed, or getting a calf for someone who's, or a goat so someone's kids could have milk every morning. So one of the things that we did, and this is what the rest of the story about, I've told you about Donna Rosa.
Yeah.
And she was the matriarch of the family that adopted me. And we had done lots of things, but she had a need that came out one day. She didn't even ask me herself. Her son asked me. She said that she had made a promise 13 years before and that she wanted to fulfill the promise. And what the promise was, well, I'll get to what the promise was. It was to start out talking a little bit about her. She had her life was difficult from birth. She was born with three thumbs. Her third thumb was just a little nub of a thumb with a nail that was just kind of sprouted off of the other thumb, and it was shaped like a heart. And she kept it hidden most of the time. But when she was a child, it was seen as a mark of the devil. And her parents died when she was like an infant, and she was passed around between half-brothers and half-sisters. They rendered her out at the village fountain of Salcedinho to wash everybody's clothes. Then she was taken in by a family, but all the kids in the to work for them abused her, and she ran away. Then she was taken, she was still like seven, she was taken in to the house by the judge because they wanted this girl to take care of their son, who was a man at that point with Down syndrome. So it's this little girl taking care of this man. And he had like accidentally swallowed a marble, and everyone thought he was going to die and threatened to kill her if he died. So she ran away from that. It was this amazing life. And she ended up working the fields, never keeping any of her wages till someone sold her to a man to be his wife when she was 13. And she told me she'd had 13 kids. Six of them lived. And the youngest one, Edna, who was 13 at the time, she's the only person I've ever met who could sing full voice out loud, sound asleep. So that's most of what I remember of Edna. Anyway, she was a miracle in herself, but Donna Rosa, in that childbirth, thought she was going to die. It, blood, everything came out. Terrible, and when she was dying, she made a promise. She prayed to God, and she prayed to Padre Cicero, if I live, I will do this thing that I was going to help her do 13 years later. And Donna Rosa maybe is the most religious person I've ever met. She prayed all the time. I think in all these things, escaping from the judge, all these situations she'd been in as a child, she was always bargaining with God. If you let me survive, I will say the rosary 5 hours a day for the rest of my life. Well, she did that. So a lot of times alone, she was always, her mouth was always moving. She was always praying, fulfilling these promises throughout the day. And, but this wasn't just a prayer to God. It was to Padre Cicero. And Padre Cicero in Brazil is the patron saint of the poor in the Northeast, except he's not a saint. He was a priest. His miracle, because to be a saint as a miracle, is sort of like a horrifying Brazilian miracle in a way. He gave the host to a girl, and reputedly, in her mouth, the host transformed itself into a piece of bloody meat. Because it is the body of Christ, right? I think that Vatican might have been horrified by this miracle, and so for a while they, I don't think they excommunicated him. Anyway, all through the Northeast, the very poorest make a pilgrimage to Juazeiro do Norte, where he was a priest. And usually it's about these promises of surviving some, or try to get a cure, or just for help. Mostly about the terrible things that you have to undergo when you're poor. She had made a promise that she would go to Juazeiro. This was the promise. And there's a church, Our Lady of Perpetual Health, I think, that she would climb the stairs on her knees. And then when she got the top of the stairs, if she survived this terrible night of giving birth to Edna, she would set off 12 bottle rockets. Well, that's,
I love it. No,
that's what I
thought.
It's beautiful. I didn't understand. It was, if you know her, because she was so, she governed her family in whispers. She was so quiet. She kept things hidden. So this promise, and understand how extreme it was someone who is so inwardly reserved would do the most painful thing that they could imagine, which was to be huge, mm-hmm. to climb in front of everyone what would be embarrassing, and then to top it off, the 12 bottle rockets that would shout out, "I am." Well, we said, we'll go. We'll pay your way, but we're going to come too. The ride was in a flatbed truck with these brightly colored, like bleacher benches, screwed to the flatbed truck. And it was full of people. Two women on it, I remember, must have made promises too that they would sing the entire way. So they were singing prayers the entire way, but they were different prayers, and it was cold in this truck. So we got there. Ooh, Donna Rosa and her son, Zay, he came with us. They snuck off in the next morning, and not snuck off, but they went quietly, and she fulfilled her promise. We didn't go because promise wasn't to us. And we already knew how hard it was for her. But that day, it was a pilgrimage. The town was full of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. But my real vision of it was, there's a statue of Padre Cicero. It's this big gray cement monstrosity with, he had a long coat and 20 buttons. The statue was 100 feet tall, and he's holding his hat and looking very white. And he's on this sextagonal pedestal, and there's this huge arena where people, the thousands of people, mill about in a circle. And we went there, and it was so crowded, people pressed against it. As I approached it, you could hear this moaning sound, and it was people moaning and sobbing, and holding the statue. I remember we walked just among them, or just sort of got carried by the crowd, and his hand was on the statue, and he was saying, "Oh, Padre Cicero, take the sickness out of this girl's sick head." And it was this young 12-year-old, this bewildered girl that was there. But the scariest thing was, as you approached, you hear this roaring sound. And I had no idea what the roaring sound was. And we were climbing the stairs. And you got over the other side. And there was these big cement banks where people placed their votive candles. So if they had a wish or something from Padre Cicero that they wanted, they'd light a votive candle and place it there. Except there were so many candles burning at once that it was a giant wax fire.
Wow.
Of all the needs of each person. In the poorest of the poor in Brazil, all coming to this place, asking help from this terrible 100-foot statue of an anti-communist priest. Anyway, that's all I can think about. With the pandemic, and I just am thinking of how big those wax fires must be now and for years to come.
Oh my, yes indeed, how big those wax fires must be, and just the raging virus there in Brazil right now, and the variants there. They are facing a very different phase of this pandemic than we are, and to have personal relationships with people in a place that is under siege in that way must completely transform your understanding of, or your ideas about, or your thoughts toward that distant struggle. And that's one of the things that I admire most and appreciate most about travel, is that it brings the world to you in a way that no other medium can do. Storytelling comes so very close. Being able to hear about the experiences of people who have traveled to distant places makes those other people's lives real to us in a way that isn't if we read. I mean, you know, you can read books, hear songs, see films, see plays, view paintings or sculptures of these places, but nothing compares to actually being in that place, just absorbing that sense of the people there, the culture there. And, you know, when people like Keith or Beverly, his mom, who told that story about her experience in Bolivia, when they relate those tales, or people like them relate tales like that to me, it makes the world simultaneously feel bigger and smaller to me. And there's one thing Keith said very early in his story that I've been thinking about since I first received his recording. He used the word exotic when he meant to use the word exquisite, or the reverse. I don't recall at the moment, but in correcting himself, he says something along the lines of, as if anything could ever truly be called exotic. And as a person who's had the good fortune to do some travels internationally and across our stupendously large country here in America, I think I have an idea of what he means. And for me, so much of what is important about travel is gaining a deeper sense of context for the people's lives in places that we do not make our own homes or our own lives. And there is no better means for developing a deeper sense of understanding or of empathy or of compassion, at least in my view, than to visit other places, to meet other people, and to try to gain some further understanding of what it means to be a human in this huge and crazy world that we call home. And so I'm grateful to Keith and Beverly both for sharing stories of their travels. And I have one more story for you this evening. It's a short tale from a familiar voice. He's been on this program. I heard one of his stories twice, and he's also been to the Story Slam in the past. Dr. Peter Rice did send me a story that pertains to work that he did here in the greater Ketchikan area back in the 1970s, and I will turn things over to him now.
This takes place back in the 70s when I first came to Alaska. The first job I had actually was working on a traditional wooden salmon tender called the Westward, owned by Snapper Carson. And this was at the time, the winter. I came up in January, and this story probably relates to probably February or March. It was a skinny economy back then, but this was before the pipeline, and fish prices weren't very high. So everyone was kind of always scrambling to figure out how to make it through the winter. And Snapper had just recently purchased this boat and had boat payments. The idea was to mimic another character who had for years taken his fish tender down to Seattle, loaded it up with produce, and come back, I don't know, two or three times a year to sell at the dockside at various small villages and logging camps, as well as a little time in the bigger cities. So Snapper decided to do this as well. And so we embarked on a trip back down to Seattle, which is about 72 hours running straight through. And we got to Seattle and then loaded up the wooden fishing tender, which was a classic schooner, so the house is aft and the hold is forward, with produce. And by this time, he had actually put a wooden cabin over the hold, hatch cover, I mean, and so there was more storage in this kind of little wooden building on top of the deck. So the sorts of things we would load up would be bags of potatoes, unwashed, by the way. There's a story to that one. Cases of apples, cases of bananas, oranges, cases of hams, cases of slab bacon, and cabbage, cases of cabbage. And then we'd come back up another 72 hours and start selling it first in Ketchikan, then going to Metlakatla and around to various logging camps. The process went fairly well. There was a few lumps and bumps along the way. For example, he had, I guess it was cheaper, ordered unwashed 50-pound bags of potatoes. So there's a fair amount of complaints about the fact that people are buying dirt along with potatoes. We learned the hard way that you don't put cases of bananas in a tight little stateroom, which is essentially, there was three or four of them. It was basically one bunk behind a door. Because what happens is they rapidly get brown. So we were trying to peddle cases or less than cases of brown bananas at each port. We also found out that having cases of fruit in the little house I described a minute ago isn't so good when you're battling a northeast storm, so to speak, going across Dixon Entrance. And so we headed up towards Portland Canal to try and keep it from coming to us on its side. And with all of that banging and heaving around, we had apples spilling out onto the decks and overboard, but we were unable to deal with that because it was too rough. The final thing that I remember from those trips, which actually were a lot of fun and generally people really appreciated the opportunity to buy bulk goods at the dockside, was that the order for cabbage had been misread, and instead of receiving five cases of cabbage, because we didn't really feel that many people wanted cases of cabbage, but we were going to sell, you know, a few cabbage at a time, but we got 50 cases of cabbage. So that was a steep climb to try and peddle 50 cases of cabbage, which we were unsuccessful in doing. And so we made another trip to Seattle and did the same thing, you know, maybe 3 weeks later. We had stored the cabbage somewhere. And so then on the second trip, same idea. We had the old cabbage, and so we peeled off three or four layers of cabbage to get to a smaller head that was still looking good. But we were still unable to peddle, I don't know, by then it was probably 25 cases of cabbage, freshly peeled and smaller heads. And so at the end of it all, we ended up dumping the cabbage as you would think, on the backside of Pinnock Island, and it washed ashore, and it was a really heyday for the deer, and because we checked on that later. But yeah, that was a classic 70s kind of trying to make it work kind of story, and it was a good memory. Thank you.
50 cases of cabbage. I mean, I honestly feel like you couldn't move 50 cases of cabbage in Ketchikan today. And I really feel like, I also feel that Peter and his crew might have missed an opportunity. If I had to deal with 50 cases of cabbage, I think I'd try to find a couple of big barrels and a whole lot of vinegar. I don't know. I feel like, although I'm sure those were some very happy, if not puzzled, deer on the backside of Pinnock Island. I love, too, the thought of maybe some early morning angler coming out for a little trolling run and seeing a couple heads of cabbage or even a case of cabbage floating down along the West Channel there. That is all of the three storytellers that I have for you this evening. I am so pleased to be here. Once again, my name is Jack Finnegan. If I didn't mention at the top because I was just running and gunning from the Wearable Arts Show, this broadcast, the Stories of Latitude 56, the radio edition, is produced in partnership between the Ketchikan Area Arts and Humanities Council and KRBD, which is where I'm broadcasting from this evening. And it is a pleasure, as always, to be here with you. I am so excited to get started again with the live Story Slam. We're going to have more details about that in the coming days. Keep an eye on social media or check in with ketchikanarts.org. I know that we'll be up on Tuesday, May 11th. Our first theme is fortunately/unfortunately. So fortunately, unfortunately, if you have a tale along those lines, or if you'd like to hear a few stories along those lines, please join us at the Creek Street Cabaret. Typically, we meet at 7, and stories start at about 7:30 p.m., $3 at the door, and I look forward to being in a room with you all again soon. We'll be back here on KRBD on the third Saturday of next month, and I'll be plugging that show at the Story Slam on that Tuesday. Thank you for joining me, and I hope to see you and hear your stories soon.